previously on Getting the Mecha.
The prologue arc has concluded with the epic conclusion, that is, the showdown in Tokyo 3, the battle against Ramiel. For the sake of Evangelion, she is a very necessary character, and she definitely pushes characters to a more extreme. Asuka is the third child and the third person to have somewhat of a synchronization with one of the EVA units.
This is Getting the Mecha, the weekly anime and manga show where we take things one step further. I analyze everything from arcs to OPs to episodes in my wacky but enjoyable quest to make sense of all of it. Welcome back to Getting the Mecha. I'm your host Jamal today, and in today's episode, we are discussing Neon Genesis Evangelion Episode 9. I'm gonna go into why I like this episode, and I'll quickly talk about why we're actually reviewing this episode slightly later. But first off, Getting the Mecha has been reviewed 5 stars by Polo Born a Fly. Thank you very much for the review, Polo. I know you have a podcast, so if you do want to check out his podcast and also his partner as well, check out the Mic Check Waifu Waifu podcast that comes out on a weekly basis. They're doing some really cool stuff reviewing anime. He says, great show. This show deserves more love. It's truly awesome. Thank you very much. And as I said before, if you do want to check out the Mic Check Waifu Waifu podcast, I should put a link in the description of this podcast. If not, it'll be in the show notes somewhere, or just check Twitter. I follow them and I talk to them a lot, so you should probably find their link somewhere. But for today's episode, we are looking at Neon Genesis Evangelion Episode 9. I'm going to do a bit of an analysis on that. And to be honest, the reason why I do like this episode and the reason why I am reviewing it is because I just enjoy it so much. So I'm looking a bit more at the finer details here, looking at some themes that emerge, how the sequencing and all that is done, how it stands out to the other episodes, and a few more things. So here is the episode for this week. That is episode 26 of Getting the Mecha, an analysis of Neon Genesis Evangelion Episode 9. Before we get into analysis, as always, here is a spoiler warning for Neon Genesis Evangelion basically up to episode 9, and in that I'm referring to the 1995 series of the show. I don't know if the stuff of episode 9 actually occurs in the rebuilds, because I'm very behind on the rebuilds, I actually haven't watched them yet. I'm going to do so this year, basically all in one, before 3.0 plus 1.0. I have a feeling it does occur in Sadamoto's manga, but I'm not too sure, so just to cover all bases, be aware for spoilers if you are not up to this stage in Neon Genesis Evangelion. If we're to refer to NGE in terms of arcs, this is around the action arc. This is the middle of the action arc, actually, after Asuka and everything like that. So if you haven't reached this stage, I would recommend watching those episodes before listening to this analysis podcast. Neon Genesis Evangelion Episode 9, as a part of the original series of Evangelion, I'll be honest, is probably one of my favorite episodes of anime ever. But ironically, although I am analyzing this because it's my favorite ever, one of, I don't know if I can say objectively it's my favorite. However, I would say also that I'm not analyzing this, or these themes didn't come out of my analysis when I was initially watching Evangelion. If anything, I didn't really notice a lot of things when watching Evangelion for the first time. It's only within this rewatch, which I've been doing, looking at all the arcs and stuff, which I realized things, because I'm almost looking for things. And so the things we'll be talking about, if you are new to Evangelion, maybe things that you didn't realize, and that's not a bad thing. You're not really missing out. I feel like the beauty of Evangelion is that the more you watch it, the more things you find, and the more things you kind of question, the further you go on within it. And so with all of that being said, let's actually talk about the episode itself, and let's get into a plot summary of NGE Episode 9. In order to understand Neon Genesis Evangelion Episode 9, it is essential that we understand Episode 8. Episode 8 sees the defeat of the angel Ramiel, And we also now have a new teammate, Asuka. During the Ramiel fight, a lot of the infrastructure at NERF has been compromised. The intercept system has been severely damaged and 26% of the defense capability is available over at NERF. So with both the attacking front and the defense front, it is necessary that now our pilots, being Asuka, Rei, and Shinji, attack at the water's edge in order to protect Tokyo 3 before the Angel makes landfall. The aim of the game is to defeat the Angel Israfel. Israfel is a very strong angel with a special ability, and after Shinji and Asuka both fail in their first attempt, Misato comes up with the idea that they must synergize in their attacks in order to defeat Israfel. The exciting thing I think that comes out this episode is that it's very much going to challenge my action arc analysis. When I spoke about all those things to do with Asuka, the action arc is almost a test for her. It is a test for Shinji, but it's more of a test as to where Asuka lies in the Hedgehog Dilemma and whether she buys into it or not. I would say obviously yes she does, and I'll explain that a bit later. But we get a big test as to how Asuka feels and how she reacts to certain things. Is she really the buoyant and over-the-top person we think she is? Or is she just like everybody else who's sort of grafting for attention and grafting for pleasure, as Evangelion is almost based entirely off that? One thing I want to zoom in on instantly within this episode is that the test for Asuka is really when she realizes that synergy is truly important within defeating Israfel. And cooperation is an essential part almost of human behavior. Although she seems as if teamwork doesn't matter, and sure, it might have paid off a bit in episode 8 when we first met her, but then we find out that she almost feels left out when she's not included within the sphere of cooperation or cooperation. We get that towards the middle of the episode, there's a bit of a shift, or even a paradigm shift, you could say, which I spoke about a bit in the action arc episode, when she almost makes the conclusion that Shinji and Asuka can't cooperate because she thinks she's superior, as always, classic Asuka. And then Rei comes along and is like, this is fine, let's show her what we can do. And they're on the, I'm going to call it fake twister mat, doing all the things they need to do in the right order. And so it's more of the reaction rather than the Rei part. I don't think there's much Rei to talk about in episode 9, but in this part, Rei almost triggers a reaction within Asuka because she obviously shows off what they can accomplish together in an area where, so if I map out the Hedgehog Dilemma, we have almost too far away from people, and this is theoretical, I don't know if this truly exists, but we have too far away from people, an area of isolation where people can't live without one another, and then they drift inwards and more inwards, and then we get almost two together. So if you Think of it like a diagram of the Earth, and too far away is like the crust of the Earth, and as we get closer into the core, that is too close. We can't be within that area. We have to be sort of in the middle area where we're close enough where we can cooperate with one another and we can feel emotions almost, but we're not too far away to the extent where we're feeling hurt by other things. I think that's the relationship that Rei and Shinji are able to showcase to Asuka in this part of the story. And then when she realizes that, she kind of decides to take a bit more of a pragmatic decision and go along with cooperation anyway. Which I think is quite a bold move for someone like Asuka. If you listened to my episode before, I kind of shared my slight distaste for Asuka as a person. And for her to sort of suck it up and cooperate with Shinji, I don't know why she doesn't like it, but she just isn't bent on doing it anyway. But for her to cooperate with Shinji is a pretty big deal, so I'm impressed by that. So Shinji and Rei, as I said before, are in this middle area where they can seem to get things accomplished. And I think within that part of the show, or this episode, by the middle, it's about 10 minutes in, 15 minutes in, I don't remember the details. No, it can't be 15 minutes, about like 12 or something. And she gets that realization that this is what can be accomplished with Although she's obviously not thinking of the hedgehog dilemma, I don't think she's aware of it at this time of the story, or at least throughout Evangelion, but she's aware of what one can achieve through cooperation, and it's a beautiful thing that she realizes. It's a beautiful thing that we realize by the end of the episode, which I think is quite exciting. So she almost has what I would consider an excuse my Christmassy language still. She has a bit of an epiphany similar to Scrooge in A Christmas Carol. She realizes after something that's done right in front of her face, this is what can be done, and this is what happens when something isn't done. She doesn't have that as visually or in such an impactful way. The most she gets from, or the most she learns from this, I'd say, is when they obviously lose the battle, but Asuka being Asuka will just pass on the blame anyway. So when she realizes she's not within the inner ring of, say, Shinji and Rei, and isn't included within something because she can't assert her dominance when she's not included in something, it's quite a big deal for her. If we take a bit more of a closer look at Shinji though, I would say that this varies a bit, and Shinji I think is the opposite. He's not too far away within this sphere of cooperation, which I'm going to probably keep saying throughout the episode. He's not really outside the sphere of cooperation where he's isolated and completely cold. If anything, he's the opposite, and he's felt almost too much warmth at this point in terms of the hedgehog dilemma. We get that in that brief moment, probably one of the, I don't want to say weirdest moments, because that is obviously devoted to Iyoi. The moment when he's about to kiss Asuka in the night is funny because later in the episode she learns that, or she already knows. But at this part, I'm kind of questioning how Shinji's coping within such an environment. He's almost overstretching the boundaries from someone that was quite, I don't want to say conservative, and I don't even mean that in a political sense, but he was very aware of his surroundings. Unlike when he was first moving in with Misato, he was quite to himself, all about being organized and closed off, wasn't really buying into the whole collective notion, almost like Asuka at this point, but subtract the roundiness. Shinji at this stage now has been assimilated within this whole idea or culture of the household that he has a place there, and it's his home, he feels warm within it, and takes that a bit further. As you can tell, I'm probably waffling at this point because I don't really understand Shinji at this point, because obviously we know that Shinji, he does quite a few things throughout the series. He's always deviating between someone that's very isolatory, if that's even a word, or isolationist, and then also quite, I don't want to say jovial, but he's able to fit in at times. I think he does that with his friends up to the series, in terms of, we see that even within this episode, he's comfortable around others. Unlike by episode 1, he's even uncomfortable around Misato. So we're seeing some shifts within characters, shifts that will probably change the dynamic of the rest of the show. So it's really interesting to observe how this episode captures that in a really obscure way, a way that I didn't see when I first watched this episode. I went a bit on a wild ride when it came to that topic, but I think that's not even the main debate of this episode, or at least the main idea or concept that comes out of this episode. I think the main concept, or at least idea, is what does it mean to be a child? I kind of picked up on this as we go through the episode. There's a lot of reference to why adults are adults and how adult behavior is distinct to the one of a child. So I'm going to dive into that in terms of how we're looking at themes today. In order to gain a bit of insight, or at least have a criterion for what it means to be a child, although I'm not really going to be able to define it, but when we look at maturity and those sorts of things, I think it's right that we have a definition as to maturity. So the psychological definition of maturity, according to the amazing thing known as Wikipedia, is the ability to respond to the environment and being aware of the correct time and location to behave, knowing when to act, according to the circumstances and culture within a society that one lives in. So that kind of adds into our hedgehog dilemma thing. Can we argue that Asuka is mature because she's able to adapt to the situation and therefore feels maximum pleasure and almost has a reward out of being mature? I don't know. Maybe. I think Asuka, although we can say she's mature in terms of the psychological definition, Within this episode anyway, she kind of lacks an understanding of what it really means to be a part of a team. As I said earlier, this is a learning process for her, so I think she definitely does learn about it, but she's quite naive as to why it's important that we cooperate. If we go a bit earlier into the episode, she says that her job is to pilot the Eva, and then the other character, which I'll discuss in length of Yay, so sneak peek, the other character then says to her, no, it's to defeat angels. And that those different views, kind of what does seem more mature within that scenario, I would push back and say it is to defeat angels as opposed to pilot an Eva. She has a very naive view of the world, I think, not only from that phrase, but throughout and leading up to episode 9 as a whole. She doesn't really gauge what everything's all about. She kind of just feels as if everything is around her and only her. But then understanding the importance of others in order to obtain pleasure for yourself is something that she learns from today's episode, or this episode of Evangelion. So, what does it mean to be a child? Although we have defined maturity and what it means to be immature in the context of psychology, I think it's rightful to say that the lines are sort of blurred between childish behavior when it comes to adults and children. There's quite a big split in Evangelion when it comes to the adults and children. We have the school kids plus our pilots, and then we have Nerve, which is basically all adults. We do have some slightly younger adults within Nerve, but most of them are quite adult. They know what it means to be an adult, or not even means, but they have experienced adulthood for long enough. One way I think we can look at how or what it means to be a child or what it means to be mature is through the main premise of the episode. And in comparison to most of Evangelion, this is probably one of the funnest episodes. It's one that is quite different to most of the themes. It's something that's funny. You can laugh at it. It's enjoyable. Let's not say Eva as a whole isn't enjoyable. But if someone was to see this episode out of context, they probably would think that Evangelion is quite a happy show, or at least something a lot more lighthearted than what we know it to be, if they were to descend down the dark hallways of end of Evangelion and the final three episodes and those sorts of things. They would consider Evangelion is in a completely different light. And so I can say that the obvious answer to be what it means to be a child is someone that is able to do the things as a part of this episode, which is, I don't want to say completely embarrass yourself, but basically completely embarrass yourself in the sake of doing this larger task, which is defeating an angel. Within this episode, children are perceived as these flexible, and I don't mean manipulated in the bad context, I just mean in terms of they're easily flexible, and you can make them do what you want them to do, because most of them are quite open-minded. If anything, despite Shinji's shenanigans from episode 1 to 8, he is quite open-minded within this part of the show, or at least episode 9 in particular. Rei is almost a tool that can be utilized for any task which needs doing, and maybe she's sort of the base level of like the childhood metaphor, and then with emotions and stuff being built on top of that, we get, say, Shinji. Asuka is kind of another level of complexity in how she wishes to assert dominance and gain pleasure from the scenario. She's looking for her own self-interest within a situation like this, and she doesn't gain it until she understands that she's missing out on it as we progress through the episode. If anything, Asuka acts as if she is an adult within this part of the show, and she's considering, what do I get out of it, as opposed to just going along with the mission. So the lines are kind of blurred in that area. If we look at someone like Kaji, I would say that he actually contributes to blurring the lines even more. He kind of engages in this sort of playground behavior between Ritsuko and Misato, playing between the two as looking like, although Misato and Kaji are like the thing, engaging in what seems to be, oh, Misato's my girlfriend for one section of the show and then Ritsuko for another. He kind of doesn't care about those sort of boundaries and barriers. He's almost a free spirit. Some people would obviously disagree with me and say that Kaji is kind of mature, and I would agree he does have some nuance as we get later into the show, which I won't discuss. But at this part, he doesn't really think about things like pride and all that. He's just there for the mission and that's it. similarly to the children. Ironically though, he comes up with this really interesting phrase, or at least sentence, which I want to discuss, not too much, but he says something. But during the scene of which Asuka and Rei are basically sitting at the table after their first loss with the angel, and then Asuka asks why everyone's so uptight, again, sort of asserting a weird childlike behavior, although when we progress further, I think it's a bit more adult-like. But again, expressing that childlike behavior, and then Kaji says, adults are much too aware of their credibility. I think that summarizes my argument quite clearly, and that kind of defines why there's this divide between adults and children within this show. The adults aren't flexible, they're not able to pilot Evas, but it's not only that, because we can talk about the science of that within the logic system of Evangelion, but it's being able to hold this pride and honor above a mission, which makes adults a lot more less flexible and a lot more entrenched within their own ideas, versus on like the children, which don't really have much to consider. What credibility, if you think about when you were, I don't know, 13 years old, and I'm not saying that's the age of the children within Eva, but say you were 13 years old, besides school, what else did you really have to think of? Obviously, everyone has their own circumstances, so I can't make that decision for you. But in comparison to someone like Gendo, there isn't much to think of. And so you live your life as a child, and when this burden is put on you, which is Pilot and Eva, the adults don't see it as much of a big deal, because what credibility does it come with besides piloting a mecha? Basically nothing to them. Although I don't really agree with that as a whole, it is kind of interesting how adults perceive credibility and how these credentials and status make up who you are, as opposed to who you are as a person and what you're capable of doing. It's more like you're the head of NERV and therefore you have this responsibility, or I'm an adult, I have this responsibility. You're just piloting an EVA, you don't have much responsibility. And so I conclude that pride and responsibility, I think Asuka does exude a different type of responsibility though, is a concept which is almost universal within the show and within us as humans, if we reference to Evangelion. It's how we perceive responsibility, pride, maturity, which is so different within us, which makes it so hard to come to terms with. Or at least how we interpret it between one another is so different and very contrasting. The questions which are raised within the episode as to, say, who's responsible for whose feelings, and that's in relation to the relationship between Kaji and Misato. Why is someone like Misato responsible for having such feelings for Kaji, or vice versa? What within us defines that? Nothing really. It's kind of just a random concept which we define as people living within a society, in this case Tokyo 3. We also learn about, say, Fuyutsuki's relationship with credentials and how as an adult he has almost too much pride. You can see when they do quote-unquote embarrassing things at the end, although they still defeated the angel, he's not laughing, he's face-palming, because he has almost too much pride for this. What defines pride? What makes one more full of pride than the other? What makes one have a higher reputation than another? That is sort of something that it's played around with in this episode. But I think the answer, at least the main answer which I would propose, is self-interest, or at least benefit for one another. Asuka, in this case, gains pleasure from taking out the angel because she feels happy, she feels like she's receiving praise for it. Shinji, probably a similar sort of concept, he feels happy when doing it. These are things that are only possible with the Hedgehog Dilemma in play, and what we feel is happiness and joy and accomplishment when we achieve such things, and then when we receive something like negativity or whatever the opposite of praise is, when we receive discouragement, it sets us back from that. And so I think in order to obtain pleasure, which I would say is probably the main sort of philosophical goal or thing, not only as a part of Evangelion, but in terms of philosophy, everything does boil down to pleasure and pain. And obtaining pleasure is still the primary objective of someone like Asuka, Misato, Shinji, Ritsuko, or anyone within Evangelion, if we can maybe exclude Rei, because Rei is a wild card. But This pursuit of pleasure, at least this endless pursuit of pleasure, is what one gains out of being quote-unquote responsible. If we take Fuyutsuki, out of being responsible or maintaining pride, we take down angels and we advance the mission, or at least the objectives of Nerve. So I just want to take things back a notch a bit. We spoke quite a bit about some ideas which I got really tangled in. I can't truly gauge it, but I'm trying to understand it still. However, one thing that I can say is that I really enjoy this episode, not particularly for its, you know, its philosophy and all that. It's just the fact that it's a really fun episode. This is, as I said earlier, one of my favorite episodes of Evangelion because it's out of context, at least. It's so fun and exciting. The sequencing and the build up to this one takedown is so exciting to witness. Even if we subtract philosophy and we take a deeper look into those sorts of things, it's just a bag of fun. It's a very bright episode for Evangelion, and I think one of the things that makes it so bright is the sequence towards the angel fight, or the angel fight and the sequence building up to it. One of the people we can attribute to this, although I didn't check for all the animators as a part of this episode, but one of the people I'd like to credit specifically is Masayuki. That's his only name, which I can find. I think that's just what he goes by. He's the one that does the calendar sequence at this part of the episode where they circle the number and then they do some exercises, they take off the next one, they do some cool things. You have loads of interesting hand movements when Asuka's moving her hands when on the board, or the fake twister reaction thing. I don't know if they actually have twister in Japan. If someone could tell me, that'd be really cool, but I don't think they actually do have twister in Japan. But utilizing the hand movements, the exaggeration when the door closes on Shinji and his face instantly just blurts, it's a really fun part of this episode that makes it quite enjoyable. It's one which I think deviates from Evangelion, because one thing that I think is maybe the flaw of the show, although this can apply to any narrative, is that sometimes you get so caught up in all these ideas, particularly in a rewatch. You can get really caught up in all these ideas, and if you perceive Evangelion as sort of a philosophical commentary or something like that, it gets very overwhelming and something to just take away from that sometimes. I think of this almost like a beach episode for Evangelion. Think of it as a beach episode with philosophy, but out of context again. This is just fun, and I wouldn't say that there are things that influence the show that much from this episode, but I don't think that's always important. Sometimes you just want to enjoy anime. I think anime is something to be enjoyed, and a really entertaining and engaging part of the show that's almost hyper real at times. There's no sort of disruption. It's a linear episode, similar to almost any classic narrative. Although we have the loss, but after that it's the slow mountain to the climax, we defeat the angel, the mission's over, that's the episode, that's it. But back to Masayuki. Masayuki has done quite a few works on stuff like Fooly Cooly, Kill la Kill, Little Witch Academia. I'm referencing things that are kind of more the anti-narrative side, and although Masayuki didn't have, I don't think anyway, had influence within how this episode was meant to contribute thematically to Evangelion, even through those works, you can tell that this isn't something that's supposed to be dead on in line with the rest of the narrative. It's kind of one that just adds a bit of faith to the story. And ironically, although I won't, as I've said earlier, not going to go too into the rest of the show because that is for our Descent arc and Bitter End analysis. However, this is good for contributing to the drops within the series. It's these moments which show us what the Hedgehog Dilemma is capable of, and then when we realize the adverse effect, it's going to feel a lot worse. So if we build up these characters to feeling pleasure, when pain is experienced, I think pain is going to feel a lot more worse, or there's a larger drop-off between the highs of these characters and then the lows, which are really low within Evangelion. I think that's most of this week's sort of essay or lecture. I've had a bit of trouble trying to get through all of this. The Evangelion rewatch is definitely helpful, but Evangelion is so complicated, I think, when you're analyzing it from the perspective of these complex themes, that it is really easy to get twisted within it. And I think that's something I've kind of done within today's episode. But anyway, here is the Link the VA segment You're probably wondering, why is Link the VA at the back of the show? I'm changing the format a bit. If you do like Link the VA in the middle of the show, just tell me and we can figure something out. But at the moment, I'm going to try and push Link the VA towards the back of the show and then do in the moment, almost like right afterwards. So we have our fun segments towards the end and the lecture for most of the episode. So anyway, here is the Link the VA segment for this week. This Link the VA was a hard one, and I'll say why, because the thing about me is that I think the Link the VA segment proves every week that I haven't watched enough anime, or at least the anime required to always make a Link the VA with the voice actors that I know, or at least anime with roles that I know. So the Link the VA segment is quite simple, although I've probably put you off it now, but the Link the VA segment is quite simple. All I do is I go onto my anime list, go to the anime we're watching, so in this case Neon Genesis Evangelion, find one of the roles which I just want to zoom in on. In this case, I was looking at Fuyutsuki, but I had to pivot a bit to another character, and then find one of the voice actors and look at all of the roles that they play, and then just have a bit of fun with comparing the characters and their voices. In this case, for Fuyutsuki, I found one which will probably interest some of my listeners, although I have not watched Mobile Suit Gundam, and I'm a failure as a mecha watcher that I haven't seen Gundam. It hasn't been something that's popped up for me recently, although there's a chance that I might get into Gundam sometime, maybe after Monogatari, although I was considering watching Fate, who knows. But Motomo Kiyokawa is the voice actor which we're looking at today, and in the case of Mobile Suit Gundam or Mobile Suit Gundam, he actually voice acts Temrei from Mobile Suit Gundam. I know that this is going really far back to some of the original stuff, although I don't build either, I'm not that in the know at the moment. However, for the listeners that do understand Gundam, Temrei is your shout out. I got to get some Gundam representation in there somewhere. So this is your chance, guys. Thank me. Okay, don't actually thank me, because I don't know enough about Gundam yet. But I will join the train sometime. And as I said earlier, I had to pivot. So this time I pivoted to looking at Hikari from Evangelion. She is basically one of the school children that we meet a bit more. Not in full detail, but Hikari is just one of the other school friends basically within the show. And I went even deeper, and I'm not looking at just an English dub. I'm not even looking at the Japanese voice actor. I'm looking at the Italian dub actor for Hikari, and that is Frederica De Bortoli. She plays quite a few roles. I think she's actually kind of known within Italy for dubbing, I think, anyway. And there are two which I want to zoom in on. One of them I literally just noticed, and the other is one that I'm quite excited about. And that is not even with me being in the know for the series. So this one is Kagome Higurashi from Inuyasha. I know Inuyasha's pretty popular. Again, it's one of the ones that I just haven't watched that I should have watched. Long form just discourages me in general, but again, it's something I should probably watch anyway. I listened to the dub after looking through pages of YouTube to find a tiny clip, and I like it, kind of. It sounds still kind of cute when you think of it. This is still a girl, and when you consider the relationship in Inuyasha, it kind of makes sense. But it speaks very fast, and that makes sense because I know that Italians, I believe, speak at a different speed. So I understand that. It sounds quite nice. It doesn't sound like something that looks out of character, at least. So that's something, again, for the Inuyasha listeners or the Inuyasha fan listeners. And then we have the second one, which I unfortunately couldn't hear the voice for, but it's one that excited me, and that is Casca from Berserk. As you know, on almost every podcast as of recent, I talk about my Berserk journeys. Although I haven't mentioned Casca that much, to be honest, but I talk about Berserk a decent amount on the Indie Moment segments of the podcast. And seeing Casca was actually kind of interesting. She's in the Berserk trilogy, or she's voice acted her in the Berserk trilogy, the trilogy movies. I don't know whether, I might as well just not speak about the voice acting at this point, because I can't find the voice, so I can't really pass a judgment on it. I'm sure it's good, but I can't pass a judgment on it. So that made me think. Should I watch the Berserk movie trilogy? Should I watch Berserk at all? I don't know. Maybe I will sometime, but I think after reading the manga, I don't really want to be unimpressed by what's happened so far. The manga is just so good visually that I don't feel like I need to be stimulated through like an animation of showing what has happened within Berserk. I'm okay with how it looks and feels at the moment. The black and white makes it feel gritty, and I'm very much within the mood for it within the manga. So I don't know if the trilogy is something I want to get into. Although that's probably my Berserk rant for most of this podcast, because we have the indie moment segment and I'm not talking about Berserk for the first time in a long time. So celebrate. So that has been the length of EA segment for this week. Slightly weak, not even slightly weak, very weak in the moment segment this time. I just didn't want to keep going down our dub actor rabbit hole, which we usually do. Although I obviously always try to go for the Japanese first and then if not English dub. But I just wanted to mix it up this time. So Italian dub it is, and I'd love to do other dub actors as well and see who they play. And with that, if you have enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review similarly to Polo for the recent podcasts I've been doing. It really helps just spread the love of the show and it helps me out and hopefully makes you feel cool as well, leaving a review on iTunes. It takes basically no time. All you have to do is go onto the iTunes app, type in Get in the Mech on the search bar, big yellow icon as usual, rate and review the show. Click the 5 stars and write a review. Anything helps and it's really appreciated, so thank you for your support. Well, let's actually pivot to the In The Moment segment now. So I'm changing the format a bit. I don't know which bit of music I'm gonna do, but let's pivot to the In The Moment segment and talk about what I've been reading and watching this week. This week, unlike the Link the VA segment, I have something actually interesting to talk about. Two things I want to discuss today. I'm trying to keep it down to two because I think it's better that I zoom in on two rather than talk about like 5 things I've been doing. First thing, I have been watching Fire Force or Ene no Shobutai. You're probably wondering, why are you watching this now, Jamal? It's 2020 and the show started in summer, I know. So a quick summary of my life as of recent. So exams and school up to around July-ish. The show, I believe, started around June-ish, kind of. So summer season, that started. Exams finished around June-ish also. And then by then, it's just been busy, although those summer, obviously. I was catching up on some other anime. Starting the podcast, that's my excuse. So we did that, and then it's now 2020. I've been producing episodes. I've had these two episodes waiting for me for a very long time. So that's episode 1 and 2 of Fire Force. For some reason, I just didn't feel like watching it. I don't know why. Nothing put me off. I have people in my timeline discussing Fire Force almost every day when the show is on and debating it. So I had no excuse, basically, and I just went around in circles and wasted like a minute of your life. So yeah, Fire Force, I'm enjoying it. I don't really understand why people criticize it a bit too much. I don't know, I think the show one at least looks beautiful, and that's not even a first episode only take. This is about 3 episodes in. This show looks so beautiful. It's Sakuga is on point. Its environment as a whole gives me sort of Ao no Exorcist vibes. I'm getting a lot of Ao no Exorcist vibes from the show as a whole. The whole team dynamic thing, the you're a devil, but kind of not a devil, and you want to go past that. I'm enjoying that as well. The art is really varied. I'm still getting the Soul Eater vibes from it, but also it feels like its own thing. I don't really think it's worth comparing to anything at the moment. And no, I'm not going to do the is Demon Slayer or Kimetsu no Yaiba better than Ene no Shobutai. I don't have enough experience in either shows to say so anyway. But I'm enjoying this one for sure, and I can't wait to see where it's going to go. And then we have a few more arcs. I'm really excited for Netherworld arc, because from what I've seen of it, it looks so good. And the way things are progressing, there's a main antagonist. So I'm willing to see how this goes. I haven't really been into battle shonens recently. I've kind of just stepped away from them to watch some other things. Not in terms of, I'm not being the battle shonens, those are too immature for me, elitist guy. No, it's not like that. I'm just not really feeling them at the moment. So I'm getting back into it and I'm enjoying it at the moment. So really excited to see how this progresses. But as always, I resort back to my degenerate self, degenerate content. So I'm reading this kind of annoying shoujo manga thingy known as Netsu Suzo Trap, or I think it's referred to as NTR or something like that. What can I say? What can I say? I enjoy it. Is it good? No, it's really annoying and it's kind of about manipulation. These two girls are going out with two other guys, but meanwhile, one of them actually is more interested within the girl. And right from basically the first chapter, she's already like down her places. Things are interesting. It's not really borderline H. Think of it more like Kuzuno Honkai in terms of the things you would expect to be graphic within H just aren't really shown. They're more of implied. And okay, things happen, but they're not getting over the top within it. It's not like this Nozaki Anna, for example, but definitely some friction, some manipulation. I'm excited to see how this progresses. So that's most of the show. Let's go to some closing thoughts for this week. Let's just return to Evangelion and just talk about what I think I've learned from episode 9. So what was the point of looking at episode 9 and what is really my obsession with episode 9 of Evangelion? It's nothing more complicated than the fact that I just like it a lot. It's a really fun episode that's distinct from most of them, I think. I think Eva sometimes can be a bit of a sad show or one that is at least quite down. I don't feel completely happy always when watching Eva. I'm more focused and maybe because I'm viewing it from hindsight, I feel like I'm seeing the show a bit more from the emotional perspective, or at least looking at the deeper parts, which Eva fans and people look at more of, rather than just looking at the bare bones of it. And episode 9, I think, is a good way to escape all of that. And yes, we can still analyze its themes, but this part of the show, it feels detached in a good way. And one thing which I've learned from anime as a whole is just to enjoy it. And I think Evangelion embodies that, which I'm really happy about. Thank you for listening to episode 26 of Get in the Mecha. I had fun. I got really lost within the philosophy of things, but I had a lot of fun. Hopefully you enjoyed listening to me debate myself on Evangelion and episode 9. If you enjoy the show, feel free to follow me on Twitter, shoot me a message, tell me how you found the show or that episode. Follow me on Twitter so you get updates on the show and all that. That is at Get in the Mecha, the name of this podcast which you're listening to. And also leave a review if you enjoy it. Tell me what I can do better even on the review. Just give me a review, that'll be very nice and appreciated. If you want to check out the show notes, go to getinthemecha.home.blog in order to get the show notes and all the things I used to research this episode, the music I put in this episode if you're interested in that, and all of those sorts of things, a summarized bit of the episode. So you just get the basic gist of what I spoke about. So thank you for listening to this episode today. I have been your host Jamal, and this has been Get in the Mecha. The music in this production goes as follows. 8-bit title screen by Joth. Mandatory Overtime by Joth. Go Lucky by Chasers Gaming. Difference by Chasers Gaming. Mandatory Overtime by Joth. Improvisation by Alex McCulloch, and Anomaly by Eric Medea's UndersoundImage.org.